Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, folks, this is Rabble Rouser and Rich Bergeron.
Yo, ladies and gentlemen, it's the Tornado, 10 a.m.
And we're coming to you live with the Combat Sports Show from Fight News Unlimited. With a special guest tonight is going to be Beck Hyatt, who is a female MMA fighter who's going to be on the Invicta 6 card this Saturday. And she's got a 5-2 record facing an undefeated Japanese fighter. I don't have her name right in front of me, but I will get that before we get her on. We had a lot to talk about tonight. Hoping Tom's going to be able to tune in. I actually just missed a call from him earlier today. I don't know what he was calling about, whether to say he couldn't make it on the show or what. But we'll see if he signs in. If not, I guess we'll try to reach him on his phone. He might not be near a computer.
Yeah. Well, I was telling you before we get on the air, I'm kind of hobbled up here. We went to, some friends and I went to a concert the other night, and Kid Rock, great show. And I'm going to give you a funny anecdote from that in a few seconds. But we're at the concert, it's over. My one friend went to get a cheese stick. So we did a 24-hour place, you know, Pots and Geno's. That's where the tourists go, but that's where we went that night. And my friend parks his Escalade. I'm in the back seat. I go to get out, and I damn near step one of those lovely Philadelphia potholes. And twisted my ankle pretty good. So I hobble over and get my steak. Playing to my buddy, I'm like, yeah, we're still on for the gym tomorrow, right? He's just going, come on, man. We're not going to get home until 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, yeah, so? I said, this is my little cheat day. I want to think about all my pretty girlfriends. And I go, so he pitched out on me, but it's okay. And my dad went. We did some work with the punch mix, and feel a little hobbled, but you know I'm getting through. But two interesting points from the concert that are boxing related. I saw Craig Gruden there. Rich, do you know who that is?
No, I have no idea.
He had some pro fights. He only had about 5 or 6 professional fights, retired from boxing over a decade ago. But he does a lot of work with the Philadelphia Boxing, retired Philadelphia Boxers Foundation, and he's trying to get me to come down there once a month and help out. So I'm going to talk to him more about that. But he was also a collegiate All-American the year before you got there, 1997. He was a collegiate All-American silver medalist from Lock Haven University and was my roommate in the 97 Nationals.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I bumped into him, you know, our pictures on Facebook now with me and my big cowboy hat. And then I also, I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but I had a message from Ken Cooper, you know, Lock Haven boxing coach now. And first, you know, Coop rarely calls me. He usually messages me or you know, sends me an email. So I got a little nervous when he first called me and left a message because, obviously, you know, everybody's very worried about Dr. Cox, you know, as he's getting older, and tomorrow is the one-year anniversary that we lost his wife, Mrs. Cox, Monica Cox. And a lot of people didn't think Doc was going to be able to survive 6 months, you know, without Glenda. And, you know, I get this call from Cleveland, I really got nervous. So I sent him a text message because I couldn't hear. And I said, hey, Coop, I'm at a concert. And he just texted me back the scouting report of the Valley Forge Casino where Tom and I went last month. And I'm not sure, but I think they might be looking to have some college boxing there, maybe the Nationals. So I left Coop a message, and I'm waiting to hear back from them, because I think that would be freaking awesome. You know I would be there every day. If they had a 3-day national tournament there, I'd be there every freaking day.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, real cool. Of course, you know, during my tenure at Lock Haven, 4 years, nowhere close to the Philadelphia area did we ever compete. It was me. New York City, awesome. Reno, awesome. Kentucky, awesome. VMI, Naval Academy. The closest I fought to home was actually Lock Haven. technically, time-wise, yeah, you could say Annapolis, Maryland. They were going for about 3 hours. But close, no. I'm fighting up in Lock Haven, Penn State, Mansfield. State University in New York, Westchester. The very next semester after my eligibility's up, we had one in Newtown, Pennsylvania, which is a Philadelphia suburb. And I got to be the fucking ring announcer. But, yeah, all my tenure, never got to play close to home. Now, practically, we're going to have one in my backyard.
Nice.
Y'all was at the casino last week for $500.
Looking for what?
I was at the casino last week. I took my mom there. They had a one of those like, promotions where they refund you all your slot losses, but it's actually a scam. Like, oh, we'll refund you what you lose on the slots if it's 75 or more, but we'll give it to you in installments as free slot play. So say you lose $100, you go back and say, okay, today we're giving you $20 to play on the slots. So you don't actually get the money back. So my one relative told me that. I'm like, well, let me just change my strategy then. Well, I'm just going to win tonight. And we were on the machine, played a little bit. We sat in the machine and said, no, I don't like this one. Went to the one next to it, third spin, $500.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, they say you're supposed to check. There's like supposed to be a diagnostic screen or something that you're supposed to be able to access, and it'll tell you the machine's odds.
Oh, no shit.
There's advice on how to beat the slot machines, and that's one of the main things. You're supposed to be able to access some kind of screen that gives you the statistics.
Really?
Yeah.
See, my one friend, he likes those penny slots, which I don't understand them, you know. I mean, I never understand how you win on them, so I just stick with strictly the quarter ones. And,
when I first went out to Vegas, I tried the slot machines to... Last night I was there, and I had all my souvenirs in a bag next to the machine and went up to my room for like 10 minutes before I realized I left it down there, and it was already gone by the time I got back.
Oh, yeah.
I lost $20, so I never did it again. But I did well with blackjack. I like blackjack. But you got to do the $5 minimum and play slow to get the hang of it.
When we were in Atlantic City last year, you know, we were gambling Sunday or Saturday afternoon or whatever it was, and Sunday afternoon. So we were finding like a real cheap craps table, like $3 minimums, and you know we had some fun doing that because we weren't going to lose a lot of money. But I played craps at like functions where they had pay money, and you're not afraid to bet it. Oh, I kill it. I'll win like thousands. But my friend that went with me last week, we went to a $10 minimum table, and he was just kind of coaching me along and giving me advice, and I played for about 45 minutes or so. I lost about $50, so that wasn't bad. I was ahead for a little bit, but I was ahead by like $20-$30. But it was more just having fun and learning.
Right.
But I'll tell you, when we went out to Reno in 98, when I fought Brian Carr out there and damn near broke both my hands, I had a teammate of mine, and he was just a real conservative type guy. Doesn't drink, doesn't gamble, doesn't do nothing. We were out there, and we finally, and he was like, I'm gonna play some. So I'm hanging with this kid from Kentucky, in South Latuna, 112-pounder, and he's playing $1,200 on the roulette table. And there's this other kid from Lock Haven playing the nickel machines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, South Latuna is putting, you know, $300 on black at one point. And then there's a kid from Lock Haven, Chad, who was jumping up and down because he won 100 nickels. you really didn't kill it. You know, Sal, if he hits that 300, he's going to be one jumping up and down, but not you for 100 nickels.
What is 100 nickels? $5?
Yeah, $5. So I'm hoping he calls me back, and you know we figure out what they're looking to do. I told him, I said, you know, that place would be awesome. I mean, they got room there, so that shouldn't be a problem. You know, they got rooms. It's a good place. The fight ballroom is nice. It's all floor seating, but I've been to plenty of shows where that's all it was, with floor seating. I know when they did shows up at the New York Athletic Center, that had more of a balcony up to it, but Most other places, the one I fought down in Richmond was all floor seating. So, you know, hopefully they decide to go with it. I think it would be awesome.
That's better than Lexington, Kentucky.
What did you say?
It's got to be better than Lexington, Kentucky, where the hotel's claim to fame was it had the biggest pool in any Kentucky hotel.
Yeah. And you know what? I know the year before when we fought out in Annapolis for the Naval Academy, the actual card was at the Naval Academy. They had, like, you know, the one, in fact, ballroom. But the following year I came and fought Jesse Bond at. But when they had the Nationals, you know, they really had to set up and had the bleachers and all that. But our hotel was like 5 miles away. So that you weren't on site. The only thing that was cool was, like, you know, different schools stayed at, like, I guess, different places. Well, we stayed at the same hotel as the Kentucky guys, and they happened to be right at the right rooms next to us. So me and the kid I bumped into the other night, Fred, we were hanging with all the Kentucky guys. And, you know, that year, I wasn't 21 yet. It was the weekend that De La Hoya fought Whitaker. And we wanted to go see the fight. So we found this sports bar that was going to be showing the fight. Fred was 22 or 23, but he looked like he was 16. And my dad was, only three of us were going, me, my dad, and Fred. And my dad goes, Fred, listen, if you and Tony walk in together, even with me, they're going to card you guys. He goes, Fred, walk in, and then I'll have Tony come in with me about 5 minutes later, which is what we did. I walked right in with my dad. My dad, you know, he goes up to me and he goes, okay, give me a 20. He goes, go get us three Budweisers or whatever. So I go off, you know, I got my windbreaker on, my name and my weight class and Lockheed on it. And the bartender looks at me, and he looks at my chest, and he looks at me dead in the eye and goes, so, how's it doing in the tournament? I mean, I let out of breath like, oh, thank God. But I'm partying with these Kentucky guys, and only one of them was 21. So we had a good time. We go back to the rooms. We were in the room next to each other. We break out of a bottle of whatever I brought, and we're, you know, doing shots back in the room. We have a great time. That crashed out of our mind. But then the following year, we're having the Lock Haven home show. 2 weeks before the show in Reno, Los Albertuna was betting $300 on black, and his kid Chad was betting to win 100 nickels. And we're at the Lock Haven show, and the Kentucky guys are there, and these guys are my buddies now. And we're hanging out, having a great time, and we're at the one bar after the show. Now, I'm 21, so, and they know me at all the bars in Lock Haven anyway. And this one kid, Jeremy, from Kentucky, who happens to now be an attorney. So, you going out to Reno in 2 weeks? Yeah, Jeremy, I am. Dude, that trip's going to be bad. I can't wait to go. It's going to be awesome. We're all going to party it up out there, and we're going to light the night on fire. Not even talking about the fight at all. He's talking about the party afterwards.
And then he announced in the bar.
In 2 weeks, he turns 21.
Nice.
The bartender gave him a look like, you got to be shitting me that you just said that out loud.
Not too smoke and fart.
Yeah, and he's an attorney now.
Wow. My old trick that I probably shouldn't give on the air, but... Hey, let's just take the chance that young kids aren't listening, or if they are, hey, I like to live dangerously. Anyway, I used to go to the bars on 18 and overnight, and I'd go in, you know, get my stamp instead of my wristband or whatever, and I would just go to somebody who already had a beer and was empty, and I'd go up to the bar and I'd go, give me another one of these. And it worked every time. They never even checked to see if I had a...
That would work. You already got one, so it's like, obviously you must be legit.
Yeah.
that's a good one. I like that. You know, but kids don't do that. We talked about it, but we did it years ago. but I know when I was 17, what I used to do, because I went to Catholic school, and... You weren't allowed to have any facial hair, even like a little bit of a stubble. So if I shaved on Monday, I would grow just a little bit enough by Friday where I would get, reprimanded, by the school saying, hey, you got to shave that. You know, I said, okay, I'll have it shaved by Monday. But then on Friday night, my friends would give me money, and I would go out and I would, you know, go to the liquor store or the beer distributor, and I'd be golden if I put a hoodie on and a hat and put a hat over my eyes, where I could get served. And I pulled that shit off a number of times, just because I looked older. And now it's funny because now I look younger. When I was 17, I looked like I was in my 20s, and now that I'm in my 30s, for the most part, you know, I still live in my 20s. I can be. I'm cool with that.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
I guess that didn't work. Let's call on Tom. Anyway, okay.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 330-475-9680 is not available. At the tone, please record your message.
All right. So I guess we're not going to have Tom. Unless he checks in later. But I do got a lot of news to cover. She's from Brisbane, Queensland, Australia. So she's probably going to have an accent, which Tony is very familiar with. His Philadelphia accent. She's fighting Mizuki Inoue, who's 5-1. It's not quite undefeated. Of Nagoya Hachi, Japan. So two non-American fighters on this Invicta 6-card international flair to this fight. But she has won all her 5 professional bouts by way of submission inside of 2 rounds. So Hyatt is going to have quite the challenge coming into this fight. Well, we'll talk about that in about 12 minutes here. Let me get her on. I do want to mention, I did catch Friday Night Fights this week. I didn't really watch the whole entire main event, but I was tuning in and out. I wasn't very impressed with Mr. Dib. I think it was another case like that Paulie Malignaggi about, even though I kind of found it funny that Teddy Atlas, who normally gets really pissed off about bad decisions, said that the one card that they should look at is the one that the judge scored it for Malignaggi. Thought that was kind of crazy, but anyway, this week they had 50 Cent's big birthday bash, and it came at some bad timing for 50 Cent because he's involved in another domestic violence case, sort of like Floyd Mayweather's, almost the exact same thing, except he ruined about 1,000 to $3,000 worth of equipment, possessions of one of his girlfriends there, and kicked down her door. So he might be facing some jail time there. And so wasn't a very happy birthday for him, I don't think. But the show went off well. Mike Oliver looked really good. It could have been better. Could have been a little more active, but he looked really good for being so rusty without any experience in the ring the last year and a half, I think it was. So
yeah,
it's
been a while.
He looks pretty well against Dib. Probably could have won the fight or at least tied it if he turned it on a little bit later in the fight. But Dib is, even though Oliver was the hometown guy, Dib was the promoter's guy. So he's kind of expecting anything close to go to him. And actually, I think one of the judges' cards had it as a draw. So it was close enough for that. And did get penalized for a couple of low blows, so that wasn't very smart. But it was a good fight. It was pretty decent for a main event. I didn't really see any weekend boxing. But, of course, the big news this week in combat sports, the biggest news, I guess you could say, is Chris Weidman beating Anderson Silva. And like I said, if I was in Vegas, I would have bet on Chris.
Obviously, I did see the replays of it. Well, I know some of my friends were talking about going out Saturday night to see it. And the one place they had it was only a few minutes from where I was going to be at the Valley Forge Casino. But I had given my mom a ride there, and I figured, you know, she didn't want to go. So I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to take you home. So the guy saw why there's some friends of mine posting, like, yeah, Silva, that's what you get for being a cocky bastard. And I'm like, oh, shit, you know? And then, it serves you right. And I was like, oh, damn. So I saw the replay on YouTube. And you're right. And that's the reason I don't think Silva would ever make it as a traditional boxer, because he breaks the one fundamental rule. And that is, he goes sometimes straight back, and he's got his hands down at his waist, and he's got his chin up in the air. And he makes some of the mistakes that, you know, like, people say, well, Mayweather does something similar to that. Well, no, not really. Mayweather always has his shoulder tucked. He doesn't have his chin straight up in the air. And, you know, what about Roy Jones from back in the day? Well, Roy Jones, similar, same type of situation. And what happened to Roy when he got a little bit slower?
But he had a lot of head movement. And Silva didn't have enough head movement in this fight. And basically, Weidman had a very smart strategy, because said after the fight that his coach, Ray Longo, worked with him to bring in fighters to the camp to get into his head with those type of antics. And if you watch the fight, you'd see that he didn't throw any punches when Silva, at first, the first bunch of times, Silva literally put his hands on his waist at one point. A couple other points, he took both hands and was, like, waving him in like he was an air traffic controller. just doing stupid stuff. And then he waited until it got to the point where it was just really ridiculous. And I think a lot of Anderson Silva's actions in this fight had to do with the fact that Roy Jones Jr. was in the audience, because Dana White invited him out because you're going to try to work out that fight as a boxing match between the two of them, even though it's kind of put on the back burner now that Silva has to have a rematch first, I think. But what really got him was when Weidman clipped him with a left hook, and then Silva acted like he was stunned. And he literally had his hands, like, down by his knees. And he was doing one of those, oh, I'm woozy acts. Like, and they described it as clowning, which is probably the best word for it. And then it was like art imitating life, basically. Because as soon as he acted that little scene out, he got clipped with a real stunning punch. And I actually used a picture from USA Today for my Rant Sports article on it. And you could see the eyes rolling back in his head for real as he's in that position of trying to fake being stunned just before he falls to the mat. And then he fell, and he had his head slammed back against the mat with the next couple punches. And you could actually see Herb Dean come in and clip him in the head with his foot before he could get Weidman off of him. So he got banged up quite a bit. And he didn't have any facial damage. He didn't really seem woozy at all after he got up and got his wits together. But that's the first time he's ever been knocked out in the cage, you know, any promotion. And it's a 17-fight win streak over the 17. So unbelievable to see that happen. But it had to happen eventually, and there was a lot of experts and fighters who picked Weidman to be the one to do it. And I don't think the next fight's going to be that different. I mean, unless Silva, you know, really goes back to a completely traditional defense and changes his game plan completely. I mean, it'll be different in the fact that it'll probably go more rounds, but I think that Weidman will still win. And he was able to get him down and tenderize him in the first round with some wrestling, which we haven't seen since Chael Sonnen's first fight against Silva. So it was pretty good. I mean, all around it was not what I was expecting, but it was good to see. And then what really surprised me was how humble Silva was after that fight. And for a little bit. for a little while, I started thinking, geez, you know, did he want to lose this fight? You know, is this a setup? Is this ridiculous? He almost was like, you know, thanking everybody and getting ready to retire in the cage there. And Joe Rogan actually asked him, you know, are you leaving MMA right now? And he said, no, I have 10 fights on my contract, and I just don't want to fight for the title again, which is very weird. You know, it kind of made me think, well, did he purposely lose this fight just because he wants to fight Roy Jones Jr. in a boxing match and doesn't want the, you know, the title thing to get in the way? I don't know. It just seemed very weird to me the way he reacted.
The argument I would have against that would be how much money do you think just went down the drain with that knockout loss? I mean, now, hey, granted, this was done, you know, about 10 years ago before Jones started really losing it and getting beat. And, you know, that fight, you know, I can't tell you how much money that could have brought in. But now, you know, with Jones doesn't have the same luster that he used to have. And now Silva got the luster knocked off of him. I think that would have been, you know, a foolish way to, you know, get out of a contract because it would have, you know, I think you lose too much with it.
Right. But, you know, Dana White had to invite him there for a reason. So I guess they've got to have some kind of plan put together, or maybe the loss totally changed that, because Roy Jones Jr. said he wanted to fight too, but it would have to be very soon. So a lot of that might have had to do with how Silva did during this fight, and I would be surprised if, you know, the fact that he lost would make the fight more likely rather than less likely. But we'll see. I mean, anything's possible. I think Dana White is just afraid that if he does this for Silva and lets him do that, then all kinds of other fighters are going to be asking to do the cross promotion and go into fighting in boxing on the side, and he's not going to want to open the floodgates, so to speak, on that. But we'll see. I don't know. Roy Jones Jr., I haven't seen his take on the fight either. It'd be interesting to hear what he had to say about seeing Silva lose like that. Probably would say he needs more head movement. But also, Harvey had Frankie Edgar on the comeback trail, beat Charles Oliveira in his first 3-round fight in quite a while. He won by unanimous decision. He's been in title fights his last few fights, and this getting a chance to beat a up-and-coming contender and get himself back on the winning track. And then we had Tim Kennedy and Hodger Gracie. Kennedy won by unanimous decision, and go figure, Dana White just couldn't keep his mouth shut. I mean, Tim Kennedy went out of his way to apologize. I think we talked about this last week. He completely apologized and took back his statements that compared UFC fighter pay to being less lucrative than being a garbage man, to paraphrase what he says. He was very, very gracious. He mentioned Dana White by name, mentioned the Fertitta brothers and matchmaker Joe Silva by name, apologizing to them all, and put it out there and said that, you know, his comments were taken out of context and the UFC is treating him better than any other promotion out there. And they even gave him a bonus for, you know, putting stuff out there on Twitter that was amusing. So you'd think Dana White would give him credit and let bygones be bygones, but no. Dana White went out there and said, who the hell is Tim Kennedy anyway? You know, who wants to see him fight? And then he didn't just stop there. That was before the fight. After the fight, Dana White came back again and had more insults for him. And he basically said, nobody wants to see anybody doing the waves at a fight. And people were doing a wave at the fight. He says, here it is. Make people talk about you Sunday and Monday, said Red. When people are doing the fucking wave during your fight, I might not be too fucking excited about your fight. You don't want people to ever do the fucking wave while you're fighting. Fun at baseball games, not fucking fun at a fight. So I don't get this. You know, the guy toes the company line, takes back every bad thing he said, and Dana White can't leave him alone.
Of course not.
You know, and what's wrong with doing the wave at a fight? Why is that exclusive to baseball games?
It's supposed to be entertainment, right?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be entertainment. And if the people there are having fun, that's the most important thing. If you go somewhere and you're not having a good time and you're not enjoying yourself, what are the odds you're going to go back?
Right.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I go to a lot of boxing matches. I've been to a lot of boxing matches over the years. I can't count them. But there's been some cards that weren't really that good, or some cards I didn't have a really good time at. But I know, you know, the number of positives outweighs sometimes you don't have a great experience. But hey, if people are there and they're having fun, and people are, you know, getting into it, the atmosphere is electric. You know, and you know, there's excitement. That's a good thing.
Right.
That only benefits, you know, hey, you don't have to make everything all serious, you know, not just in the sport, in the fight game, but in life. You know, I mean, go there, let your people have fun. It's not like a Roman, this is not like a Roman Gladiators where, you know, somebody's going to die and the winner gets fed to the lions. It's not that, you know. It's athletic competition. Yeah, it's competition, and you guys want to win, and you want to fight hard. But as the fans, you want to be entertained, and you want to have a good time. So if that means, you know, doing chants and doing the way, I'll tell you, you know who always used to impress me, whether their fighter was winning or losing by having a good time, was Ricky Hatton's fans. Those crazy Brits would travel the world. They would sing Winter Wonderland dedicated to Ricky Hatton, and they had a great time. Would Dana White have gone up there and said, well, we don't want these Ricky Hatton fans coming to my fights because they sing a Christmas theme, and it's in July. Well, that, we just can't have that in a UFC card because this is a fight, and this is serious. It's from a guy that teaches aerobics. Come on.
Yeah, you want to get there doing, you know, but doing the wave, I mean, it's just like you're picking a straw, and he's looking at
way too far
in this case. But anyway, we got Beck Hyatt. I'm going to give her a call. We have her slated here for 8:30, a couple minutes late. So we might as well get her on. Here. Speaking of crowd.
Hello.
She's built. Hello, Beck.
Hey.
Hi, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron from the Fight News Unlimited Combat Sports Show. And we also have Tony the Tornado Pentacal here on the line.
What's up?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
All right, Beck, you got a big fight coming up this Saturday. Can you tell us a little bit about your opponent and what you're expecting in this fight?
I'm fighting Mizuki Inoue. She's from Japan. She's 18 years old. They call her the child prodigy. She's a good striker, a good grappler, and loves judo as well. So she's coming to this fight very well-rounded. And she has expressed her feelings to want to stand and bang with me, so that's always going to be fun. A lot of girls say they want to stand with me until I punch them in the face, so we'll just have to wait and see if she stays true to her word.
All right. And how did you first get into fighting?
I originally got into cardio kickboxing to lose weight. I was heavily overweight, so I got into it to shed the pounds and get fit again, and I just got hooked on it.
Cool.
And that must work. You've got you down to 115 pounds. So, if you have any secrets you want to share with Rich and I, you know, we'd be happy to hear them.
Secrets to lose weight? I just avoid carbohydrates now. If I eat carbohydrates, then I turn into a big fatty.
Yeah, that's the Atkins diet seems to kind of work. I know that they've kind of altered it. Not really as popular by that name, but yeah, carbohydrates definitely been exposed. It's bad for you.
Yeah.
But as far as fighting for Invicta, I know it's kind of a new promotion, but it's been doing well. This is their sixth card here. What's that been like working with the organization?
It's been amazing. You know, Invicta treat me like royalty. The moment I get here, I get gifts and my schedule, so I know what's going on. And they, you know, they look after their athletes and they have our best interest at heart. So they've been amazing, and I'm just glad they keep bringing me back. This is the third time I've been back, third time in a row. So I'm stoked about that.
Cool. And what do you think about women's MMA in general and how far it's come, over the years?
It's definitely skyrocketed since the UFC has come on board, and really pushed us girls into the limelight, along with now the UFC, there's the TAF and all that. So it's definitely growing, and lots of people are opening their eyes and realizing that we have talent and we can actually fight.
Mm-hmm. How about your ultimate goal? What's your ultimate goal in the sport?
My ultimate goal is to be number one, just keep, climbing that ladder and win the title and defend it eventually. I just want to be number one. I want to be the best in the world.
All right. And do you have a favorite style or submission or punch or anything like that you prefer?
Everyone calls me a striker because I go out there and strike, but I feel like I'm all-rounded, but I do actually like to grapple. I do prefer to grapple, and I guess I like to throw elbows as well on the ground. That's probably my favorite technique on the ground.
All right. And Invicta doesn't ban those or anything, do they? They allow that?
No, they don't. We've got full rules.
And how about, do you have any idols in the sport or outside of the sport that helped you out along the way that you watched and learned from?
No, I'm actually relatively new to this sport. I've only been fighting for 2 years and training for three, so I haven't got any titles. I went straight into my pro debut in Australia, and five fights later I was signed to Invicta, so no titles yet. That's what I'm working for.
I said idols, like role models.
Oh, idols. No, not really. I don't really look up to anyone I just want to do my thing and stay true to myself and just be myself. I don't really look up at anyone in particular.
And who's the toughest lady you ever fought so far?
Carla Esparza, by far. We went five rounds, 25 minutes of hell. So, she was definitely my toughest fight and my biggest challenge yet.
Mm-hmm. And what's the most important thing you do to get ready for a fight?
I just make sure that I, train hard. If I always have confidence in myself, my skills, but if I haven't trained hard for that fight, then I definitely wouldn't have as much confidence. So I always, like to go into a fight knowing that I've done everything possible in order for me to win. Training hard and just putting everything on the line.
And I know I've seen at least a couple cards, mixed martial arts promotions down there in Australia. But what's the scene like these days down there for mixed martial arts?
It's growing. It's getting there. It's still relatively new. There's only a few local shows around where I live, but it's getting there. And the women's MMA is growing as well. When I first started, there was only a small handful of women actually fighting, and now, there's been women fight on every card that is around. So it's definitely getting there. People still call it cage fighting down there. They don't quite understand that it's mixed martial arts. It doesn't have to be called cage fighting. But it is getting there. It's growing.
Yeah, I remember when they...
It sounds like fighting in the States.
Sorry, what was that?
I said, your last few fights in this upcoming fight, in Kansas City, how do you like fighting in the United States?
I love coming over here and fighting. It's amazing. I love the trip. Well, I hate the flight over. That's probably the only thing I hate. But once I'm here and settled in, Kansas City is really cool. And it's a great atmosphere to fight. It's huge fight fans here. And, just when you step in the cage and they scream in your name, it's amazing.
What do you love most about mixed martial arts and fighting?
I guess I like just punching people in the face legally. I'm not getting in trouble. It's always fun.
Yeah. As they always say, the one great thing about combat sports, you know, mixed martial arts and then boxing, which is what I grew up in, it says that you get to punch people in the face, you don't get in trouble, you get paid for it, and the better you do, the more money you get.
That's exactly right. It's, you couldn't ask for a better job. You're getting paid to punch someone in the face.
And what do you think about people who say that, you know, women should just be pretty and focus on that, and they don't like to see them get hit in the face because it should be women and wear makeup?
We're still girls. We're still pretty girls. We just like to punch other girls in the face. I just honestly think they should look past the fact that we're not, you know, in skirts and being girly, that we're actually skillful athletes. And if just don't watch it. If you don't like it, don't watch it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We had a boxing versus MMA debate years back, and we had Ken Shamrock and a boxing guy on the show named John Scully. And they got into like a real bad argument over women's sports, and one had that opinion that, you know, ladies should be ladies, and they shouldn't. That nobody likes to see them get hit.
We're 2013 now, guys.
Yeah.
We can actually hold a job and support our own family now. So, open your eyes.
Ken Shamrock, being the MMA guy, was more apt to defend the women that are fighting, and I think it's kind of weird how women's boxing kind of fell by the wayside, but women's MMA is starting to hit a new peak these days.
Yeah, it's weird how that's happened, but I'm not complaining.
Now, is there anybody out there you would really love to fight? Are you really looking forward to fight someday?
I honestly just want to fight who Invicta want me to fight and what's going to get me closer to the title shot. Like I said before, I want to be number one. That's where I'm aiming for. So whoever's going to get me closer to that title, that's who I want to fight.
All right. Tony, you got anything else?
No, it was good. I want to know, we talked about fighting back in the States. We were talking about how much fun it is just beating people up and getting paid for it and not getting in trouble. You know, what is your, when you go out there, you know, how do you feel? What goes through your mind when it's go time? You know, how do you get yourself mentally prepared, you know, to punch somebody in the face like that?
I'm full of excitement when it's time to go out there. You know, you get a little nerves because you don't want to lose. No one likes losing, but I'm just more excited than just going out there focused and happy and, you know, excited to put all my hard work to the test. You know, you train 8 weeks twice a day, 6 days a week for this thing, and you don't want to just go out there and lose in, like, 10 seconds. So you're definitely, there's a bit of pressure on you, but I was excited to put all my hard work, you know, to the test and hopefully come out with the win.
All right. And tell us a little bit about life in Australia. I know a lot of our listeners are probably American-based, so they have probably no clue what it's like down there, except the old rumor that the toilets flush the other way.
Tell you about the fights in Australia.
Just the life down there.
Oh, the life. The weather's great. That's probably the best thing I love about Australia. And we talk with our Aussie slang, as you know, g'day mate, and things like that. But there's lots of beaches, lots of nice beaches around, especially in Queensland. And I guess they're quite laid back, and we follow a lot of sports. We're very sports orientated and drink a lot of beer and just really friendly and like to party pretty much. That's beaches, beer, and sports. That's pretty much Australia.
All right. I guess it's time to go visit Australia, Tony.
Nothing wrong with a good party.
Yeah. And what do you think about this upcoming card you're participating in? You know, that's a big fight there with Cyborg and Marlus Cronin on the main event. What's it like to be part of that all-star lineup there?
Yeah, it's amazing. The card is stacked from top to bottom. Like, I don't even know which fight I'm most excited about. They're all amazing fights, and it's even better that, you know, they've got the pay-per-view now, and more eyeballs are going to be watching this amazing fight. And, yeah, I'm absolutely excited about it. I just hope I don't miss too many backstage trying to get ready for my own.
And how about your training camp? Are you training in the United States, or are you training in Australia?
I train in Australia for this one. I'm actually planning on maybe next flight, or, you know, down the track coming to America and setting up camp somewhere else. But, yeah, I train at Impact MMA out of Brisbane, Australia. And I actually travel to a few other gyms in Queensland as well for some training. I have to hunt down the little people because I'm a midget. So it's nice to train with littler people. But, yeah, it's a good camp. I'm Impact MMA and training under Mal Van. They always look after me.
And so I imagine there's no shortage of people to train with as far as, you know, coaches and stuff like that in the area?
No, not at all. Like, Queensland is probably the capital of mixed martial arts in Australia, so I moved there from Tasmania 2 years ago just for that reason. So, yeah, it's definitely a lot of resources out there in Queensland.
Awesome. Do you have anybody you want to give a shout-out to or say hello to or anything like that?
Sure. I'd like to thank my major sponsor, Americana MMA, my management firm, Alchemist Management. If you can follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/RowdyBeck, and check out my cover photo. It's got all my other sponsors that have supported me, and, you know, I wouldn't be here without them. So check them out and help support the guys that support me.
Cool. It's interesting you mentioned sponsor. I know there's been a lot of talk about fighter pay, especially in the UFC this last couple of weeks. How is the pay in Invicta? Do you get taken care of pretty well?
Yeah, I agree. My new management firm, Alchemist Management, has definitely, you know, pushed for more money and Invicta come to the table. And, you know, like I said before, they treat me like royalty. So I'm very happy. I haven't had any issues, thank God. It just seems like the USC guys are having that issue. But Invicta, you know, they know their athletes' worth and they're looking after us.
Cool. All right, any final thoughts before we let you go?
Yeah, just tune in to InvictaFC.com or come down to Ameristar Hotel in Kansas City and watch me punch Mizuki Inoue in the face Saturday night. That's at 6 p.m.
Nice.
It's awesome that that's your mentality there, because when I used to go to fights, a lot of fights live, I would, you know, get drunk enough, and that's what I'd yell all the time: "Hit him in the face!" Let's hope you hit her in the face enough to get the win, and hopefully knockout.
Thank you.
Good work.
So.
It's been great having you on, and probably record speed in answering those questions. You're a fast talker, so.
Thank you. I think I've got it down pat now.
All right. Well, keep up the good work,
guys.
Like I said, and have a good night, and best of luck, although you probably won't need it. You sound like you got a lot of skill and good head on your shoulders.
Thank you.
All right. Good night. So there you have it. That's Beck Hyatt. She's got a big fight coming up Saturday night in Invicta 6. Check it out. And don't see Tom coming on anytime soon. Looks like he's dropped out for the time being. But we do have to finish talking about UFC 162. We didn't get through all that. It was kind of
look,
left.
Look how Ripken like me.
But, we left off with Tim Kennedy. Tim Kennedy had a unanimous decision over Roger Gracie. He actually apologized again for not, you know, living up to his potential in that fight. Roger Gracie is a world-class Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy. So he was kind of scrappy in there. And, of course, Tim Kennedy would have liked to finish him or knock him out or something, and didn't get the job done. So he even apologized for not doing that. And he mentioned UFC jitters are for real, because this is his first UFC fight. Also, we had Mark Munoz have a nice comeback win against Tim Boach. Unanimous decision win. And he actually said that if Anderson Silva doesn't want the rematch with Weidman, he'll take his own rematch with Weidman. He had I guess he had a majorly publicized battle with depression, and he wasn't doing too well during that time period when he fought Weidman the first time. So he said at the post-fight press conference that he'd gladly step in and take care of him this next time, hopefully. Cub Swanson was back in action and had a very impressive fight. One of the fighter night honors. I think they gave two of them away for this one. Beat Dennis Seaver up pretty bad, knocked him out in the third round, or TKO'd him with punches, and just looked like he's been putting it all together. I think he's working with Jackson MMA now, and it's showing that he's improved quite a bit. And he's probably going to end up having a rematch with Jose Aldo that is going to go more than 17 seconds long, hopefully, next time. We'll see. I know I'm going to discuss the contract payments later on, but this next fight, I thought I'd mention it, at least the payments for Chris Leben. A couple of news pieces on Chris Leben this week. Number one, he lost the fight and still made more than Chris Weidman did in the main event. I think he got $50,000 just to show. Tim Kennedy ended up getting $60,000 just to show, too, and plus more to win. But anyway, Leben in a losing effort got $50,000 to fight Andrew Craig, losing by split decision. I had mentioned last week that he could face a cut if he loses this fight. If you're going by the standard that other guys have been cut for. No sooner did I say that on the show than I read an article, I think, the next day where Dana White defended him up and down, saying he hates to even talk about cutting Chris Leben. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, he heard me. No, somebody else must have mentioned it too, so I wasn't the only one to come up with that hypothesis. But Leben's had some troubles. He admitted actually this week that he's had some opiate addictions, and he's actually the first fighter ever who was granted a exemption, not for testosterone, but for Suboxone, which is, I think, used primarily as a substitute for OxyContin addicts. They take this, and it's like methadone for heroin. So I thought that was interesting. That he said he's been sober for over a year now, but I didn't even know that was possible to get an exemption for that. But he did. So, you know, I guess Dana White still has a soft spot for him, even though he's had all those troubles and just likes the way he fights in general. But I just didn't see it in this fight. He seems to be losing his edge, seems to just not have it anymore. And, you know, who knows? Maybe maybe after his next fight, if he gets beaten even worse, then he'll just hang it up on his own. But I think he just likes to make the money and likes to, you know, keep doing what he does best. But I just don't see the hunger that he used to have and the keep going forward mentality that has worked well for him, even though it was a split decision loss for him. I just another thing that was weird about this card, I'll tell you, is a lot of these decisions were 30-27 on two cards, or 30-28, and no, 30-27 on two cards, and 29-28 on another one. And it seemed like, I don't know if it was the same judge who was always saying 29-28, but it seemed very weird to me. What different fight is this guy watching when two judges think that one guy won three rounds and the other judge thinks it's a 1-point difference? I don't know. But that was kind of crazy. I did notice that there's a lot of the decisions were like that, though. So I don't know if they're going to look into that, but maybe they should. Anyway, we had a guy who won, speaking of Australia, the Australian version of the Ultimate Fighter, Norman Park, had a nice win over Kazuki Tokudome by unanimous decision. And Gabriel Gonzaga, another guy who made more than the main event fighter there, Chris Weidman, beating Dave Herman in 17 seconds by knockout. Probably should have deserved a second knockout of the night bonus. But I think they gave knockout of the night to Reedman, so he didn't get it. But just an incredible looping right hand, I think it was. It knocked out Dave Herman. And we had Edson Barboza beat Raffaello Oliveira by TKO in the second round. Brian Melanchon, or Melanchon, beat Seth Brzezinski by knockout in the first round. Punches. Mike Pierce beat Dave Mitchell by TKO in the second round. I think we've had Mike Pierce on the show before, if I remember correctly. A few years ago or so. Anyway, I said I was going to mention the fighter pay here. Let me just find that. And I know we talked about this a lot last week, but I've written a couple articles since then on rantsports.com. I think I gave you and Tom the link. And I've only got one hater on there. That's really...
All right, I saw it. I didn't get a chance of responding yet, but I did see it.
But it was kind of funny because our old friend Holly Yargo there saw a link to another story where Chuck Liddell came out in support of Dana White, of course, because he's working for the UFC now, officially.
Yeah.
And he bitched about these fighters complaining because when he first started, it was like $1,000 to fight in the UFC. But times have changed. They're making a lot more money now. And
exactly. You know, Rich, if you work for a business, you know, and your business is just starting out, and, you know, and you're one of the guys that's trying to, you know, help build that business up, you know, obviously there's not going to be huge, receipts. There's not going to be huge profits. So, of course, you're not going to get, huge paydays. So, yeah, you get $1,000, and... Okay, and that's all well and good. But now it's like, you know, they're making 10 times that amount or 20 times that amount, and you're only getting $2,000. Well, then, well, something's not right. Or you're only getting $3,000. Well, I don't get it. You're making 20 times the amount, but I'm only making 3 times what I made. Something doesn't add up.
Well, the whole pay structure in general is just screwed up, I think. I mean... Obviously, there's a lot we don't know about, and I said this to Dana White and the Fertitta brothers. I mean, the guys from Abu Dhabi should just decide to reveal at least the fighter bonuses and base pay to shut people up if they really want to, and they really want to prove that they're giving these guys enough. But they won't do it, and I think it's too bad because a lot of these guys, their base pay is all people see, and it's very confusing. Especially when you look at a guy like Chris Weidman, who, you know, he might not have been around in the UFC very long, but he's in the main event here. He's got to fight the number one pound-for-pound guy in the world at the time before this fight going in. And Anderson Silva's making $600,000, which I don't have a problem with. That's pretty decent money. With all his sponsorships and all that and his position in the sport, he's probably making millions upon millions for every fight, in addition to what his base pay is. But he got $600,000 just to show up. Chris Weidman got $48,000, which is a $24,000 show price and $24,000 to win. You look at the co-main event, Frankie Edgar, the $240,000 for showing and winning. It's $120,000 each. His opponent got $21,000. So it just doesn't make sense to me. When have you ever heard in boxing a guy making that much more than his opponent in the two co-main event fights? I mean, does it happen? And there's an interesting article on Bleacher Report, Three Reasons Boxing is Beating MMA at the Promotion Game. And I'm going to get into that a little bit later. It has less to do with the pay structure than it just does with the way the promoters operate. And it kind of hints at the treatment of the UFC fighters at the end of it, which I really liked. But then we get to...
I ever really remember that happening a lot in boxing, was when there were fights with, one bona fide star who was making the show, and that being, like Mike Tyson. Yeah, there were times that Mike Tyson made, like, $30 million, and he's fighting, like, Bruce Seldon, who might have made, like, $2 or $3 million. But that pay-per-view was sold on Mike Tyson.
But even then, that's in the million-dollar range, and we're talking about guys. One guy's making over $100,000 or $200,000, and a few dozen grand, basically. It doesn't make sense to me why they would structure it that way. And I understand these guys sign contracts per fight. It doesn't matter who they fight and what card. But you'd think being a main event or a co-main event, even if you're an opponent and you're not the champion or you're not the guy with the more experience, that you'd have a little scaled up payment. And like I said, I don't know what the bonuses are, but it still kind of baffles me the way that the structure works. Tim Kennedy, not even in the main event or co-main event. Like I said, I got $60,000 just to show up, plus a $30,000 win bonus. So he made $90,000. Roger Gracie, $50,000. So he made $2,000 more in base pay than Weidman, who won. And Gracie lost, has been around a lot less time than Weidman, in less time in the UFC. So that's another one that just baffles me. I mean, where do they get these figures? Just because he's a Gracie? I mean, is he getting paid just on his last name and his family association? I don't know. And we got Mark Munoz here. He got $84,000, 42 to show, 42 to win. Again, way more than Weidman. Tim Boach got $37,000 in the loss. Cub Swanson made $58,000. Doesn't even count his knockout of the night, because fight of the night bonus. He made $29,000 to show, $29,000 to win. Caesar won $33,000 in the loss, plus his fight of the night bonus. I think it was either $60K or $50K. Andrew Craig, $24,000, 12 to show, 12 to win. And there's Chris Friedman, $51,000 to lose. So $3,000 more than Friedman. Then we had Norman Park. He made 15 and 15 to make a total of $30,000. And then you've got Kazuki Tokudome, $8,000, the lowest paid fighter on the card. And he won all three rounds in that fight, so. See, that's less than after expenses, taxes, and paying out his training staff. He's probably going to lose money on this fight. Probably made less than $1,000 per round. But those are the kind of payments that I really hate seeing. You know, anybody that's making less than $8,000 a fight. If you get to the UFC alone, it takes a lot of hard work. You know.
Yeah.
And I know that these smaller promotions are paying $2,000, $3,000, and stuff like that. So it is a pay boost for a guy to get to, from one of those smaller promotions to the UFC, but there's no excuse for guys making that. Win or lose, it's just too little. Anyway, Gabriel Gonzaga, like I said, also made more than Weidman, $10,000 more to be exact, 29 to show, 29 to win. And Dave Herman made $23,000. Edson Barboza, $46,000, 23 to win, 23 to win, 23 to show. Rafaelo Oliveira made $14,000 in the loss. Brian Melanson won $16,000, 8 to show, 8 to win. And Seth Brzezinski, his opponent, also made $16,000. Lose. Some of these things just makes me wonder, why do these guys get these certain deals? And you know, you're making the same amount. A fighter's making, on a preliminary fight, both these guys are making the same amount. One guy won and the other guy lost. Doesn't make sense. Then you had Mike Pierce, the very first preliminary card fighter of the night, made $56,000. Just $2,000 less than Weidman. 28 to show, 28 to win. And Dave Mitchell, his opponent, only made $10,000. So it's just the whole pay structure, I think, needs to be changed. And actually, I mentioned Holly Yargo. I didn't quite finish that story. I had an article about Chuck Liddell linked on my LinkedIn account, and her and I went back and forth on the whole thing the other day. And she is of the opinion that, hey, you know, Dana White is right. You have to prove yourself. You have to go out there. And Tim Kennedy, he's right about Tim Kennedy. He's not a guy who puts asses in seats, and that's the main thing. I get that, you know, and I appreciate that that's the way they run the organization, to the point where they're trying to inspire fighters to put on exciting fights. But at the same time, I just wonder, you know, why can't you just say, all right, I'm going to listen to the concerns out there and I'm going to do something about it. Something that they could do very easily is maybe say, all right, well, we're going to have a new bonus system where we're going to have the bonus for the main card fights that are televised on pay-per-view, or and then we're going to have a bonus system for the preliminary fights. You know, you have your Facebook preliminaries, and you have your, usually on FX now, your preliminaries. Why not impose another whole bonus system for the preliminaries and then have a separate one for the main cards? And maybe have 25 grand instead of 50 grand be the bonus for the preliminary guys. Because you have to take care of your prospects somehow. If you're not going
to
give them base pay increase, you can at least shell out another 100 grand per fight to throw out bonuses, and then you're still rewarding excitement. Another thing they could do is maybe say, all right, we're going to have a fight in Brazil, and we're going to have a lot of American fighters come down there. Maybe say, if you have to travel over 1,000 miles for a certain fight, we're going to give you a $5,000 travel bonus, because they don't pay for your travel. And they're not paying for your staff to come in either. You got to pay that out of your own pocket. And for a young fighter on a preliminary card, it's not easy. And it's not going to be like a fun time trying to stick around and trying to meet these obligations to go to these fights that are halfway around the world when you got to pay for everybody else to go with you. So maybe that's something they could do. And that way they don't have to just open the floodgates and pay these guys to the point where it's looking like they're giving in. And, you know, they're not inspiring guys to make more by doing better. You know, you could still inspire guys to make more by doing better by putting some kind of system in where they're at least paying for their expenses, or they're giving them incentive to a bonus, another bonus type of system. But, you know, they're not even going that well. They're just, Dana White is just going out there and he's insulting people who question his authority. And I mentioned that there's this article, Levi Nile over on NILE over on BleacherReport.com has this article, Three Reasons Boxing is Beating MMA at the Promotion Game. And he kind of mentions Don King and Bob Arum as the two biggest names in boxing promotion, and how they have eclipsed Dana White and the Fertittas in their promotion aspects. And it says about, just kind of funny because, you know, a lot of people have a lot of bad things to say about Don King. But he says, men like Don King and Bob Arum, the two top men in boxing promotion, have long known how to get the big names and build their rise and reign into solid gold. And it's an interesting statement here. He says, they didn't do it by condemning the fighters under their banner, as Dana White did to John Jones during the UFC 151 fiasco. Instead, they slowly build up a fighter, allowing fans to watch their rise, and in turn allowing fighters to develop a massive fan base. The boxers and their promoters might not always agree, but they keep up their differences quiet for the most part, coming out to the media as a united front in full support of the fighter. When a big-name fighter suffers a loss, he still enjoys the full weight of the promotional machine for his next few tune-up fights, reestablishing his name and appeal to the masses. Fans love a winner, and those comeback fights provide the victories needed to achieve that end. Boxing promoters that know that building big fights mean catering to the big names. It's a marathon, not a sprint. One of the great things about the UFC is the fans get to see the fights that matter, but a fighter lives and dies by their last performance. As Dana White has said many times, there are no easy fights in the UFC. And in addition, King and Aram know how to build an event by pulling all these aspects together, and their influence and connections have long attracted some of the biggest names in the sport. And he goes on a little bit later to say, it takes guile, connection, salesmanship, daring, and experience to be a great boxing promoter, and men like King and Aram have it. And he does go on to say that King is not so much the greatest anymore. He's kind of going out of the sport, leaving Aram as the top guy with Golden Boy close behind. But the best thing about this whole article on the last, it's a slideshow article, so they got a bunch of pictures with it and then a little bit of story underneath each picture. And the last slide, page four of the slides, says something that kind of is a backhanded swipe at Dana White. And it's, it says, John Jones is an incredible fighter who is still very young and fighting in the prime of his career, but many still see him as an actor trying to find the right role. In fact, most MMA fighters of note seem to take their sport and the possibility of losing in the big fight so seriously that they keep their optimism and personality under lock and key. They do their talking in the cage where it matters most. While this is exactly as it should be, they have no other means by which to attract the masses. Boxing has never seemed to have this problem, although it could be a situation they soon have to contend with. Of course, the sport of MMA is finding its way onto cable television. Things indeed, may indeed change. But here's the real part about you know, the backhanded thing about Dana White. They will still need to promote said fighters as the stars of the show, as in MMA promotions, instead of the event itself. In the end, such promotions like the UFC are really only venues where fighters display their skills. If a superstar emerges, he or she will only transcend the limitations of their predecessor by living out their dreams and by proxy seeming larger than life. And no one looks larger than life when they are treated like just another employee and expected to say how high when Dana White says jump.
That's right.
And I don't think anybody could have said it better than that. And it's very subtle, but it's a clear knock on that guy, and especially his recent behavior. And it's like, it's such a good point because it's not insulting. It's very factual. It's very short and to the point. And it's a good image, you know, because that's basically what's happening. You know, these guys are being conditioned to toe the company line. And if they do speak out, they never hear the end of it.
Right.
You know, the one guy that people were saluting for at least saying something, and a lot of people were making fun of him because he does make a lot of money, and he really wasn't making enough of a case, about, you know, the guys under him that aren't making the big bucks. He was making it about himself and saying that he could make more of the garbage money. I get that, that people were pissed off about that, but I don't get why Dana White couldn't just allow him to make an apology and treat him like a human being after that. And one of the things Holly and I went back and forth on was, you know, this, I said, this guy is a Green Beret. He's a United States soldier. I understand that's separate from fighting in the UFC, but, you know, that guy deserves respect. I mean, Dana White never went to basic training, never mind served in the military. Never had a professional fight, never mind fought in his own organization. So, you know, I keep pounding on that, but, I mean, it's one thing to criticize a guy for a fight and say, well, you know, he could have done better. But it's another thing to say you suck and nobody cares about you and why are you opening your mouth? When it's supposed to be a free country, and like this guy says in this article, you know, you have to make it about the fighters, not about the promotion. And Dana White is to make it about the promotion, as in, like, we're superior to the fighters. You wouldn't be anywhere without us, and we take care of you the best we can. If you want to do better with your finances, then go somewhere else or become a star. Well, how can
you know,
if you can't survive early ranks, you know? Go ahead.
I always bring it back to the world of professional wrestling because that's the closest thing I can associate it with. Because in boxing, like, boxing's a sport. Now, it's like, you know, sports like hockey, basketball, football, baseball, the big sports, but they're hard to say. Like, I don't think you're ever going to see a situation, and I could be wrong, I could be dead wrong, where, okay, I'm watching the Phillies game, and say the Phillies decide to leave Major League Baseball and join, like, World Japan League or something stupid like that. You know, you're not going to see that. Or you're not going to see, like, Major League Baseball, like, throw out the Phillies. You know, they could suspend them. They could put those fines against them or levy penalties against them, or they could suspend players. But you're never going to see a situation where they just, like, kick a whole team out of the league. He goes, oh, shit, hey, the Pittsburgh Pirates had 20 consecutive losing seasons. Let's just kick out of baseball. You're not going to see that. And, you know, in the world, so those are your normal sports. In boxing is like a sport where it's like, okay, you know, if you're not signed as a promoter, yeah, it might be harder to get fights. I know for like Don King, he used to be the master. It's like, oh, wait, Evander Holyfield is like the number one contender, and he's going to fight Mike Tyson, but I control Mike Tyson. So I'm going to put a deal in there that if Holyfield wins, I get his next three fights because I basically own this title, and that's the only way you get a shot at it, which I think is kind of, you know, nonsense, but that's the way it works. But if Holyfield didn't sign that deal, the organization could come out and say, you know what, Don, it doesn't matter if you won't make this fight because Holyfield is not one of your fighters. He's the number one contender, and either he fights Mike Tyson for the title, or the title's vacant, and Holyfield and the number two contender, Riddick Bowe, are going to fight for it. That's like an example. It's not a situation where, you know, Don King runs the entire sport, which is basically with Dana White. Dana White just, oh, shit, well, you know, I don't like you, or you lost too many fights, or you said something mean, or some bullshit, where I am not going to allow you to play in my yard.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it all comes down to. And that's the easiest way I can say it. But now you look at professional wrestling. Back in the day, it used to be they had territories. Like, it used to be New York, which was World Wrestling Federation. It used to be, like, Dallas was Continental Wrestling. It used to be Atlanta was the NWA, which became WCW. You had the AWA in Minneapolis. So you had all these organizations. But Vincent Mann, you know, Jr., he takes over, and he starts saying, you know what, I'm going to go national. I'm going to make, you know, a huge, you know, global promotion. And now it's, well, okay, I got this global promotion, and I'm signing the big guys. So now I pretty much run it. And when was wrestling at its best? When there was competition, when WCW and had all that Ted Turner money, and they, you know, were really putting a lot of pressure on there. Well, there was enough room for all the guys, all the good wrestlers, to get on TV, to get on pay-per-view, to, you know, really license themselves. And, you know, if they didn't want to play under Vince McMahon's rules, they could go somewhere else. But now, Vince McMahon really owns it all. I mean, no. I don't watch TNA. A lot of people don't. Their pay-per-views do nothing. So Vince really owns it all. So if Vince doesn't like you, or he doesn't get along with, you know, say him and John Cena have a big spat, or him and The Rock have a big spat, well, he blackballs them. Now, where are they going to go? Where are they going to make that kind of money? Vince McMahon is bigger than the sport of wrestling because he owns the biggest toy. That's what Dana White is in UFC. He owns the biggest playground, and if he doesn't let you play on it, you're not going to get seen. You're not going to make money. And, you know, it's not a situation where, hey, you know, John Cena or, you know, Undertaker or The Rock is the best wrestler in the world. You know, we want them, you know, to headline WrestleMania. If they don't work for Vince McMahon and they don't play by his rules, well, guess what? Ain't going to happen.
But the thing is, you know, when you use that analogy, it kind of brings up another point, which is Vince McMahon's attitude towards pro wrestling, which is sort of a soap opera in so many ways. It's sports entertainment. It's not real. It's not as dangerous in so many ways as mixed martial arts can be. You know, the guys don't. They do end up with head trauma and stuff like that, and injuries from bouncing around the ring and stuff and doing all those acrobatics. But they're not risking a concussion just about every time they go into the wrestling ring. And all the theatrics, it's for show. With Dana White, it's serious. You know, he is seriously
ridiculous. That was just my best analogy.
Right. I mean, it is a good analogy as far as the territorial stuff and the control over the industry. But Dana White acts like Vince McMahon in a sport where a Vince McMahon character really doesn't belong.
Right. No, you're right, and you're 100% right on that.
And it's like, you know, in wrestling, it thrives on your good and evil characters, you know, just like any movie or TV show. You know, you got the good guy and the bad guy. And Dana White, it's like as long as you suck up to him and don't say a bad thing about the UFC, you're a good guy. But if you open your mouth and you say anything critical or ask for changes in any area of the UFC, you're automatically a bad guy. And he has a way of telling it like it is, as people say, and getting the fans to like that about him, no matter what he says. It's just because he drops a lot of F-bombs and says it in a manner that's down to earth. People love it. They love to hear it. They love to agree with him. But it's not right. It's not right at all. And Holly was even saying, used one of my favorite words. It's like, I agree that Dana's a jack wagon, but he's right about this thing that the fighters have to perform. I agree with that too, but there's a way to incite them to perform without treating them like shit just because they want to open their mouths and speak up for some people who don't feel are getting treated the right way.
Right.
And I brought up in one of my articles the point that I have been keeping it kind of secret because it was sort of off the record, but Ryan Couture told me when I met him out in Vegas and I interviewed him, he didn't say it on camera, but when I talked to him after the fact, after the recording, about his father's experience in the UFC and everything and his bad blood with Dana, and I asked him about staying in Strikeforce. He said he wanted to make Strikeforce his career, because the UFC likes to keep you under their thumb. And what happened to him when he signed with the UFC? They denied his father from even cornering his fights. And he had to keep his mouth shut about that. His father's been the only one to be outspoken about that issue because his son, who obviously knows what's going to happen if he speaks out, has had to keep completely quiet and not say a word about it, as much as it probably pisses him off. There's no excuse for that. I mean, why are you punishing the kid, especially when he's not even making a stink about it? Just because the father has gone over to Fightmaster and supported the alternate organization and skipped out on one of his, you know, promotional deals with, being an analyst, you're going to punish the kid and not let his own father, who's a Hall of Fame fighter, corner his own son? It's just ridiculous. There's no excuse for that kind of petty bullshit in a professional sport that his owners are trying to mold into something that's better than the NFL someday, especially.
Right.
And speaking of analysts, your boy, who you I think you know his wife, Brian Stan, just announced his retirement today. Went 12-6 in MMA over the last 7 years, and the former Marine. And he's going to retire to be a commentator. He's already a commentator for the UFC on the Fox channels. But now he's going to actually commentate ACC college football.
Cool.
So obviously a lot less risky. And something that feeds into one of his talents that he's developed through commentating UFC fights and kind of doing the off-card commentary as an analyst. So he started out in 2006 with the WEC and pretty much been with the Zuffa organization throughout his whole career. In the sixth professional fight, he won the WEC light heavyweight title and knocked out Doug Marshall. And he lost the belt, but he had plenty of epic fights in the promotion. And then once he got to the UFC, he moved to middleweight, won his first three fights, including a win over Chris Leben, which we talked about earlier. And he never got to title contention after losing to Chael Sonnen at UFC 136 in 2011. So it kind of makes sense that he'd bow out now. He probably didn't really see himself getting back into title contention, and he was on a 1-3 streak in his last four fights. But he is always exciting, and he's always a great character that people like to root for with his military background. He spoke out for military causes and proudly waved the flag out there. So looking forward to...
From watching him in the WEC, that he could have been a tremendous boxer because he had natural punching power, and obviously he would have had to refine his game, but he was a tremendous puncher, so he already had a good start. He had a good building block, and I could just see right now, going back to professional wrestling with the Marine background. And now how so many foreigners are dominating the heavyweight boxing scene, like the Klitschko brothers and Alexander Povetkin and Thomas Adamack, and then even your Britons, guys like Tyson Fury out there, that he could have been like the Sergeant Slaughter character, the hero, to fight off, the foreign invasion. Obviously, it's not as sensationalistic as it was back in the mid-'80s with the Cold War and everything, but I remember so many classic battles with Sergeant Slaughter versus the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov, the ultimate bad guys. And I see how they really have promoted that. And I think Brian would have done all right.
But, Brian was one of those guys who was with the organization for a long time, but he was probably never going to make Anderson Silva money, as Dana White likes to say. So it makes sense for him. He's probably making a good, hefty paycheck without taking any risks that he would take by stepping in the ring and fighting guys that probably had a little bit better chances of winning than he did. Getting to the point where, he reached the pinnacle already as the light heavyweight champion of WEC, and he's a character and a guy that people like to watch fight, but at the same time, you don't want to keep watching him get beat up either.
True.
One side of, being a successful name in the sport, if you're not winning fights at the end, people just don't like to see a good guy get beat up, so...
Right.
I think all the ingredients added up to making that the best decision for him. And the guy does look good in a suit, obviously, because he's worn a uniform for so many years.
Right.
So, natural fit for him. Anyway, as he bows out, Tito Ortiz is making some comments on Twitter that are making people think he's thinking about a comeback. He retired just exactly about a year ago. He had a bunch of injuries, surgeries, and other issues that kept him out of the UFC octagon at certain points. But now that he's had a year off from fighting, he's kind of hinting at making a return. And although he kind of had some bad blood with the UFC over the years, and especially at the end, there is a chance that if he doesn't come back to fighting per se, he might end up on the next installment of the Fightmaster Bellator show. That's just a speculation. There's not really any evidence of that being the fact. But anyway, he's kind of made some tweets saying that nothing proves more than making a comeback. So he could come back to fighting for Bellator maybe, or on that series. You never know. And Ronda Rousey's back in the news again. I know that I sent you and Tom the nice picture of her next opponent in the rematch, Miesha Tate, our former guest on the show.
I appreciated it.
then there's another picture that reveals a little bit more of the backside that came out on ProMMANow.com. But Dana White already mentioned that Rousey and Tate had some vicious exchanges, and some hand gestures had to be blurred out in addition to the words being bleeped out for their taping of The Ultimate Fighter. But it gets worse. Rousey said there's no way she would ever do that again as far as the show. She didn't like the cameras following her around all the time. Just didn't like being watched, period. And it's kind of funny. So even fucking electrons behave differently when they're being watched. But, you know, this is in addition to her rivalry with Tate. But interestingly enough, the whole article headline kind of reveals the storyline here. She said, people are looking forward to the fight between me and Kat, and people are more looking forward to the drama between me and Misha. It's really unfortunate that it worked out that way for Kat, Kat Zingano, who was injured. But she also says that Misha was actually lucky, and it was more beneficial for her to lose to Rousey the first time around than it would have been for her to win. And when I first read that in the headline, I kind of questioned it, but she does have sort of an interesting point. She says, she hates my guts, and whether she likes it or not, she has more opportunities because of me beating her ass. And the reason she says that is basically the UFC was more interested in Rousey. And if she's making the argument that if Tate had won that fight, it would have taken a lot longer for women to be brought to the UFC, because Rousey at the time was in the white-hot spotlight, basically. She was generating all the interest and all the hoopla and the hype. And basically she says, Rousey said, I think that she hates the truth that she's better off because she lost. If she won that fight and it continued to be her as the champ, she wouldn't be as well off as she is now. She's going to try to make up for it and try to win at this next fight, but it's just not happening. We are in two entirely different leagues, and I'm going to be training harder than ever, training harder than her, doing more than her, and she is always going to be second, and that's something that she's going to have to live with. So, doesn't mince words. She's very highly charged and determined to make sure she proves that this one is not a fluke. Well, the last one was not a fluke, and this one is going to be a statement fight for her. She's probably going to try to beat her quicker than the last fight. And interestingly enough, Tate, before the fight with Liz Carmouche, Tate was the one that took Rousey the longest into any fight. And, you know, so she's got a lot to prove. And she's probably going to try to finish her in the first minute this time. And I don't have the actual article and the full quote in front of me, but I did read this week that Misha made a statement that she's going to shoot herself in the face if she gets hit with another armbar.
Oops,
by Ronda Rousey, so... We hope she doesn't take that literally if it does happen. Talking about bad boys a little earlier, a real bad boy, I guess, and a criminal actor here, Jeremy Stevens, made some headlines last year because he was arrested before a UFC fight for felony charges tied to a 2011 bar fight. And he made a plea deal that... required that he serve 15 days in jail, which he already served, and he only has to pay a $315 fine. I'm not sure if there's any kind of probation here. It doesn't really talk about that, but he had charges of felony willful injury and misdemeanor assault dropped in exchange for the plea, and the most serious charge there could have led to 10 years in prison. But he will have to also surrender any firearms and abide by a no-contact order for 5 years. No probation, though. And I don't know if this guy's related to you, but the fight in question occurred on October 15th, 2011 at Fat Tony's.
I'm a heavy set guy, but you know, I'm never going to call myself that.
All right. And Stevens and Dustin Bachman, who's 28, were accused of punching and hitting a man. Bachman pleaded guilty in March of assault and was sentenced to probation and a $750 fine. He must also observe the no-contact order and payment restitution. And Stevens was arrested on October 5th. The representative posted bond about 2 weeks later to get him out of jail. And Des Moines police denied allegations that they deliberately waited to arrest Stevens until the hours before the fight, which Dana White accused them of. Okay, we talked about Chris Leben and his Suboxone. But basically, he said, I'm a creature of excess, everything in excess and nothing in moderation. That's kind of been my motto for life. So this health thing and this energy I have, I'm getting addicted to that. It's a complete rebirth. He also said, well, didn't get into the comeback story, but I promise you there will be no relapse story. I'm going to stay strong and continue on the path. He wrote on Twitter following his UFC 162 loss, actually. So we'll see if being sober works out for him and helps him out. But not sure what's going on with him, but just doesn't see him his name in his last couple of fights. Anderson Silva, we mentioned his actions after the fight, but some couple news stories recent days have mentioned that he's had a little bit of a change of heart and he wants now to have his title match as soon as possible. And there's actually been some talk today that they're going to try to set it up for Cowboy Stadium and steal a page from boxing promotion. And they're saying that it could happen in December or February, Super Bowl weekend. But the most likely candidates to be bumped to co-main event status could be actually Ronda Rousey versus Miesha Tate on the year-end card UFC 168. But that's only speculation right now. Super Bowl 2014 is pretty much the front runner. That's what Dana White's been gunning for. And that's probably what's going to happen there. Also, I mentioned Chuck Liddell. Let's read his comments about fighter pay. We already kind of hinted at it. He was on Sirius XM Fight Club, some kind of radio show, I guess. He's now the Executive Vice President of Business Development, a.k.a. a figurehead for the UFC. He says, you fight good, you win, you get paid, all right? You're starting out, no one knows who you are, no one cares. You don't get paid, period. It's simple. I mean, my first contract I was offered by the UFC, or my second contract, it was 1-1. 2-2, 3-3. That's $12,000 for the year. Don't complain to me about fighter pay. It was $12,000 for a year, and it was exclusive. Everybody doesn't want to hurt the lower guys from getting paid, but it comes down to it's a performance-based business. You get good, you win, then you get paid. People got to understand the fighters are at the top are the fighters that are supposed to get paid because they're the guys that are bringing people in, bringing eyes to the TV, getting pay-per-view buys, and putting people in the seats. I mean, that's what it comes down to. You want to get that? Beat everybody. Be good enough. If you're not good enough to get there, sorry. It's not a welfare state. You picked the wrong sport. Hey, you made a good run at it. You tried. Try another sport because this one doesn't work for you. So that's Chuck Liddell. But you also have to remember that Chuck Liddell was Zion's number one sponsor, starting their promotion with the UFC. And he reportedly had a $1 million contract with Zions. And they're still turning to him today to market the company, especially now that they're under UFC ownership. They're throwing them bones here and there, $5,000 to show up at an event and wear a Zions shirt here and there. So he was taken care of outside of the cage, even though he wasn't making very high base pay. Now, we've rewarded boxing for most of this show, so definitely got to get back to it on this one. Emmanuel Stewart would have turned 69 last Sunday, and since his death last fall, boxing remains barely alive in Detroit, but the Kronk boxing brand has sort of been in hibernation. Some boxers have been displaced, some quit, and others work out with former Kronk trainers in small dingy gyms and unfamiliar studios. But former boxing champion Thomas Hearns wants that to change. And he said in an article this week, "I made boxing famous here in Detroit, me and Emmanuel together. In order to bring boxing back again, we need somebody consistently doing fights. If you do, the people will support it if you give them what they want to see. Nobody wants any jive or junk. As long as you give them some great fights, some good talent, and make it worth their while to spend money." And the Hitman excited Detroit with his quick knockouts during almost monthly bouts at Cobo Arena and Olympia Stadium. He fought some of the most exciting and high-profile fights in history: Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, and Marvin Hagler. Titles in five weight classes, and was named Boxer of the Year in 1980 and 1984. That should count for something, shouldn't it? And sadly, the old Kronk gym on McGraw closed in 2006 because of the economic downturn. Hearns was there last fall when the signs and boxing equipment were cleaned out after Stewart's death. But it would be great to see somebody continue his legacy, Stewart's legacy. He's one of Detroit's most important sports figures. He sank his money, sweat, and energy into the gym. He often footed the bills for boxers during out-of-town trips. That gym must be reopened. There are a number of displaced boxers that need a home. And Anita Ruiz, who sits on the board of the Kronk Gym Foundation, says, "We are seeking a building in the city of Detroit. We are seeking funds. Financing could start with the opening of a Kronk Hall of Fame. Imagine people walking in to see pictures of the greats and then leaving with Kronk gear. It would be a top seller that would energize the emergence of a new Kronk gym." However, the drive cannot be a one-man operation. Stewart's family, Kronk Boxing, Hearns, and the business community must come together to make something happen. Hearns says, "I'm looking for investors who want to help me bring boxing back. It's very doable. We still have great fighters. I have kids I want to work with who pattern themselves after me. I want to give them something to latch onto and give them the hope where they can say, I have the ability. I can make it. I can do this. And you can count on at least two other people to join the cause: world boxing champion Vladimir Klitschko, who said during Stewart's funeral he wants to help revive boxing in Detroit, and promoter Jackie Callen, who wants to honor Kronk." And actually, I interviewed Jackie Callen years ago when I first started Fight News Unlimited on MySpace. Well, you have the Motown Museum, and that seems to be working out well and attracting a lot of tourists to town, Callen said. "Motown is Detroit, musically speaking, so I guess in that respect, Kronk is Detroit sports, at least for boxing. But financing alone won't revive the sport in Detroit. There needs to be someone young, energetic, and talented to take the top reins in the ring. God bless me with the ability, but if we can get somebody else like me that God blessed and they have the desire, that would be fantastic," Hearns said. "It's hard to find somebody who wants to give their all. It is about giving your all and being what you want in boxing. If you put something out there, you will bring something back." That was from the Detroit News. Pretty interesting. It's good to see Tommy Hearns getting back involved. He's kind of been out of the spotlight. I know he does, you know, still attend some events here and there, but he's not, obviously not as, you know, out there and out in the public eye as he was when he was a fighter. Another story here about Floyd Mayweather. Do you have any comments on that one, Tony?
No, I think it's a great thing, you know, Tommy Hearns is doing. You know, because look at a lot of the guys that came through, you know, Detroit. Obviously, you know, a very area that has gone through, you know, a difficult stretch. And it helped out, you know, not just a lot of Detroit fighters, but other fighters that came there to you know, learn and be mentored by a guy like Emmanuel Stewart. And you know, he did a lot of great things for a lot of guys, and it'd be a shame for that, you know, just to, you know, fall by the wayside because he has since passed away. Somebody should be out there, you know, to keep not just that tradition alive, but to keep that memory alive and to keep, you know, that, you know, willingness to give something back to the community and help out, you know, those, you know, in that area.
Right. Here's interesting article, too, on CNN, believe it or not. Did a big piece on Floyd Mayweather's newfound relationship with his father. They call it a complex life story. And it says, at such a degree of bad blood that even psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud might have had trouble exploring the demons that have been unleashed between father and son. And it makes specific notice of the time when Floyd Sr. was shot in the leg with a shotgun while holding Floyd Jr. And he admitted that he was holding on to his kid so he would make sure he wasn't shot in the face. I never heard that part of the story, so pretty interesting. But Mayweather Sr. had last taken charge of Floyd's corner in 2000 prior to being booted out of his son's house and life shortly after. A notable feature of Floyd Jr.'s unanimous points decision over Guerrero, Robert Guerrero, the WBC's interim champion, while Mayweather was in prison, became the fact that he had tightened up his defense, a product of his father's work, the fighter said. My dad is a remarkable trainer, a defensive wizard, the man with a 44-0 record told CNN. Floyd Sr. knows about the importance of avoiding major injury all too well. He has frequently recounted how he was shot in the leg by Tony Sinclair, the later brother of Floyd Jr.'s mother, in 1978. And Floyd was one at the time, said Sr. And he said the move to keep holding on to his son was a move that he believes saved his life. I wasn't going to put that baby down. I got shot. Oh, here it is. I wasn't going to put that baby down, Floyd Sr. told the Los Angeles Times in 2012. I didn't want to die. It wasn't about putting my son in the line of fire. I knew Sinclair wouldn't actually shoot the baby. So he took the gun off my face, lowered it to my leg, and bam. Floyd Jr.'s defensive skills, I just keep jumping around, are such that he has long been known as Pretty Boy because of the fact that he has boxed many bouts so well, his face has been largely unblemished. And it was basically for not taking any punishment, said Floyd Jr. You know, I can't be over the age of 30 calling myself Pretty Boy. I'm a man. His fight against Guerrero was the first of a six-part deal with Showtime, with every bout worth at least $32 million. So he's it's one of the reasons he's been named as the Forbes magazine highest earner in sports. And when he signed the 30-month deal in February, the 36-year-old Mayweather said it would be his last as a professional fighter and that he would be retiring when the contract ended. But he seems to have had a change of heart, given comments he made on Monday while promoting his next fight against 22-year-old Mexican sensation Saul Canelo Alvarez in September. He says, after my five more fights, guess what? I think after getting to 4-9-0, we may stay in the sport a little longer, told the crowd of 5,000 strong at the Alamo, of all places, in San Antonio. And there's been a speculation that Mayweather's decision to recall his father reveals a desire to finally bury the hatchet, with his 60-year-old suffering from lung disease, sarcoidosis. And when asked by CNN what he'd learned from his time in jail, a sentence earns after he assaulted his former partner, host Josie Harris, the mother of two of his children, Mayweather gave the following reply. Never take anything for granted. As far as you could see a person here today and gone tomorrow, so never take anything for granted. And Mayweather actually learned his boxing skills from his father, former fighter who was stopped by Sugar Ray Leonard in 10 rounds in 1978. And until Floyd Sr. was given a 5.5-year jail term for drug trafficking when his son was 16. And that meant he was absent for the bronze medal his son won at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta and the start of his professional career later that year. Floyd Sr. did train his son when he was released in 1998, but the pair fell out soon after that, with their last fight taking place in 2000 as the then junior lightweight champion, when Floyd was defending his title. Floyd's uncle Roger took charge, but there's little loss between the siblings, even if Floyd Jr. may be trying to change this in the way in this, in what may prove to be his toughest fight so far. So, pretty decent article. And getting back to MMA, there's a sort of a funny little side story here I thought I'd bring up. We just talked a little earlier about, you know, boxing being all about the fighters and the UFC being all about the promotion. And every article I've seen where they compare boxing promotion to MMA, they always mention guys like Chael Sonnen. Because, love him or hate him, he's polarizing. He has as many haters as he does fans. And like Dana White, he's very abrasive sometimes. But he also has quite a sense of humor. I mentioned in a past show that he actually participated in a parody with the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia show, where he pretended like he was going to be taking the place of one of the characters. You know, he's you know, never avoided trying to be funny. But over the July 4th weekend in Las Vegas, he participated in a fan Q&A session, and he told everybody that he's there that he doesn't have a UFC contract right now, but if he were to sign one, he would have some demands. And it sort of reads like a David Letterman top 10 list, but I think it's funnier. It says, demand number one, Jallo Biafra replaces Bruce Buffer as ring announcer. Every fight I'm in must be a number one contender fight or a title fight. And if I lose, I get an immediate rematch until I win. No media can look me in the eye or they will be removed from the room. Headset legalized through the commission so I can call my own fights, is his next demand. Yeah, this is a good one. No longer will I walk to the ring. I need to be carried. And I think he's kind of targeting Dana White with this one. Keys to your least favorite Ferrari. This is a good one. I must be able to Skype or FaceTime my fights if I don't feel like flying. And somebody has to tell GSP to quit being such a dick. I'll return his truck when I'm done with it. So Sonnen actually also explained it's not all about the money, people. There's more to these contracts. They're very sophisticated. And it should be noted that earlier in that same session, Sonnen was asked to give advice on how to build a brand as a fighter. And to that question, Sonnen replied, first thing, when you're asked a question, remember that you are not under oath. I don't answer questions. I handle questions. So that obviously, the contract thing was how he handles questions. And we talked about Tito Ortiz wanting to make a comeback. Here's a fighter who's still under contract, technically, with the UFC. Still has, I think, at least one fight left, if he wants it. Nick Diaz, even though he's deep in the throes of starting his own new promotion, he said he's not quite done. He emerged from his cave to proclaim he was going to try his hand at a fight promotion with War MMA. But one show after the start of that promotion, he's already pondering what's next because he isn't sure that fight promotion is really his game. So 4 months after his retirement, he's appearing poised for a return. He recently took to Instagram, not Twitter. He's, I guess, more fond of the Instagram, so I'm not too familiar with to reveal that he'd broken up with his girlfriend and is now looking for a fight. UFC President Dana White surprisingly said he's more than happy to get Diaz about if he's really serious about returning. And he still has a deal with the UFC despite his earlier proclamations about retirement. And the promotion never went ahead and ripped up that deal. So Dana says, he said he broke up with his girlfriend, wants to fight. Dana, get me a fight. Nick Diaz is under contract with the UFC. Whenever Nick Diaz wants a fight, I'd be more than happy to get him a fight. And Diaz was in attendance during UFC 162 fight week, but he had no actual meeting with White while in town. While Diaz's cryptic way of asking for a fight doesn't necessarily mean he's returning to the cage anytime soon, it's a safe bet to say he will be back. One of the possible opponents would be a rematch with Carlos Condit. And he after that fight, he said he might be done with the sport then. And it turned out he was done for 12 months at least, because he got a suspension for marijuana. Now that he's got all his smoking out of him, I guess he's not ready to hit the shuffleboard courts and wear bad Hawaiian shirts just yet. He does return. There are plenty of nice matches for him. Condit or any other contender. Probably be an intriguing fight to put him up against Rory McDonald. And he's got sort of a long-standing feud with their camp, with the McDonald's camp at TriStar Gym in Montreal. And it's the same one that George St. Pierre trains at. And McDonald also has a win over Nate Diaz, Nick's brother. So we'll see. I talked about Tim Kennedy's issue with Dana White. But I didn't mention Dana White came out with some other sort of contradictory comments. First, he says, you know, to everybody that complains about fighter pay, that you're either delusional or moronic or moron. Now he's saying to all future and current UFC fighters, this isn't a long-term fucking job. You don't come into the UFC thinking, man, I'm going to stay here until I'm 65, and then I'm going to retire, get a pension, and do this, that, and the other. This is a fucking short-term gig. And it all started, this outburst started as a question about Stephen Bonnar's final days as a UFC fighter. And more specifically, the conversation centered on the reality of the life of an athlete who steps into a cage and tries to separate another athlete from consciousness. Why continue to have, you have a window of opportunity that's about this big if you're lucky. If you're talented enough and you get in there and you do as many amazing things as you can in front of as many people as you can and make as much money as you can and enough contacts and this and that, so when that inevitable day that will finally come when it's over, you put yourself in a great position where you can move on and do better things. And if you figure it out right, you don't have to ever work again. Who the fuck on this planet doesn't understand that? Well, obviously he doesn't understand what he thinks he does, because if that's his opinion, and it really is that short of term, then why can't he understand that these guys, even at a lower level, need to make more while they have an opportunity to make more? And what he doesn't mention, but it's all obviously underlying in these comments, is that the reason it's a short-term gig is because it's dangerous. You know, you can't keep up that pace forever without injuries, without, you know, major head trauma, pugilistic dementia eventually a lot of these guys end up with. So you don't want to just hang in there forever and too long and keep getting beat up. So whether you're, you know, a title holder or a contender or, you know, a top 10 name in the sport or not, you need to get paid while you're still fighting. And you need to get paid for the risks that you're taking and for the fact that you're good enough to fight for that organization. So they ought to take care of you so that when you do improve, if you improve, you'll stick with that organization rather than go somewhere else because they don't treat you right. So, you know, it's kind of interesting, too, that Mike Tyson is a big fan of the UFC and was at UFC 162 on Saturday night because he's one of those guys who made millions upon millions of dollars, and people who he associated with either took it away from him or didn't encourage him to save it. So he ended up squandering most of it, and now he's kind of reinventing himself to stay in the positive red, or the black, rather than the red.
Get off the air. I know we only got about a minute to go. I just wanted to give a quick mention here, and I didn't realize this until I saw it posted on Facebook a few hours ago, but today is the fourth anniversary. I can't believe it's been that long since we lost our Zero Gotti. I know his last fight, I was going to an Italian festival that night, and we only stayed for like 2 hours because we wanted to go home and watch the fight and It was painful to watch, but, you know, it was kind of good. We wanted to see the closure of his career. And then, you know, 2 years later, 2009, I'm going back to the very same festival. And that's when I got the text message that, you know, he was found dead in Brazil. And I can't believe it's been 4 years. So I just wanted to give a shout-out to Arturo Gatti, thank him for all the memories he gave us. Me as a 15-year-old kid in my first fight. And then the great trilogy with Ward, the world title fights and everything. And I just wanted to give a shout-out and thanks for the memories, Thunder.
All right. And until next week, folks, thanks for stopping by, and we'll see you next week, and we'll have another guest for you.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Adios. Signing off.